I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time is 9:01 and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Clayton Margaridge. Patsy Kullberg is our engineer. The Old Mole is a weekly program of radical commentary about the state of the world and its future. Let's get right to today's theme.
You say the last elections didn't turn out like you planned. You're feeling blue and clueless, you just don't understand. You're sad and sulky, somber, sullen, moping and morose. You're woeful, doleful, weak and weary, semi-comatose. You stare at your computer screen, devoid of joy and hope. You're so depressed you can't get dressed, you're noosing up a rope. But just remind yourself when you can't stand it anymore that we've been through some crappy times before. We've been through some crappy times before.
Well, many of us are trying to recover some semblance of equanimity after the news on early Wednesday morning that Donald Trump had won the election. To that end, it's important to try to understand what happened and why, and also to think realistically about continuing to spread our vision of an egalitarian society, even during the Trump years. What can the left do now to defend what has been gained in the past and to keep alive our vision for a better future? On the show today, we will be discussing why Trump won, focusing on how white working-class voters for Trump think about the issues. It's important not to simply dismiss them as ignorant bigots, not only because many of them are not, but because this attitude, coming from some liberals and some leftists, and widely expressed on Facebook and elsewhere, only aggravates the working class's resentment of the left. Then we will look at the tasks facing the left in the coming years. The movie moles will be here to look back at the 2004 film The Manchurian Candidate and exploring the role of corporations in manipulating the electoral process. All this and more coming up on today's Old Mole. But first, what happened and why? We have a guest contributor to today's show, one Jack Johnson. We'll hear his contribution in two parts. In the first segment, he presents some insights into how some white male voters are able to see themselves as an oppressed minority, displaced from what they see as their rightful status in this increasingly multicultural, multi-ethnic society. I'll follow with a somewhat different take on how the left needs to relate to those who support Trump. And now, here's Jack Johnson.
This is Jack Johnson reporting for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I was asked to produce a segment before the election to sit down with two Trump supporters and to figure out what made them tick. I sat down with them for 3 hours, and I was prepared to put together a nice segment, taking clips from the discussion, illustrating certain points. But now the election's done. We all know the result. And I think there's a better course. I think it's better if I just tell you what I learned and then state in a few words where I think we are. Here's what I learned. The two men I spoke with felt that they were in a minority that was being oppressed by the majority. They inferred that being in the minority was in fact oppression and that it justified dismantling the system. That's a big leap, and I wanted to know why they thought they could make it. They were hardly the first minority in American history to feel oppressed. But they were the first, to my knowledge, who inferred directly to the need to dismantle the entire system. I was also curious why they thought this man, Donald Trump, was just the one to deliver what they were after. Why did they think he would set things right? He was, as we all know, manifestly unfit for the job. Well, it turns out the answer is pretty simple. These white men regarded the system as their natural possession, not in a reflective way, not even, I would say, in an explicitly ideological way, but reflexively. If they found themselves in the minority on issues that they cared about, it could only be an injustice. And this could only indicate that the system was, in fact, already broken. To bring in a man like Trump couldn't do any more harm and might just do some good. Now, this position was, before the election and now after, so obviously infantile that I couldn't help asking if this wasn't, in fact, a tantrum. And they didn't deny it. So, long story short, I think white America had a tantrum and elected an infant president.
And that was Jack Johnson with an interesting take on the thought processes of some Trump supporters. These two white men feel that they have become members of an oppressed minority and that their oppression justifies electing an authoritarian bully with no respect for civility or the rule of law. And they are able to believe this because they feel, rather than think, that it is this very system of civility and law, which they might call political correctness, that has exiled them from their rightful place in the hierarchies of race and gender. So let the system be trashed by Trump and his thuggish supporters. Unlike many on the left, Johnson was willing to sit down and talk at length, trying to understand Trump voters. He paid attention to the way they think. But it's also important to understand why they think this way, in particular, why they feel oppressed. It has to be more than their racism, the white privilege they feel has been stolen from them. One reason Trump won was that a great many white men and women in the Rust Belt, who had voted for Obama both times, switched this time to Trump. What they wanted each time was change, a reason to believe that their lives might be better. The Democratic Party, the only other realistic choice, had rejected the much more popular Bernie Sanders in favor of a representative and a symbol of the existing order of things going back to the 1990s. Hillary Clinton promised to incrementally pursue the Wall Street-friendly policies of her husband and those of Obama, who, for all his style and grace and gravitas, has presided over an economic recovery in which nearly all of the added wealth went to the already wealthy. Middle-class folks are hurting. Their economies are weak. Their children can't get good jobs, and their neighbors are burying their sorrows in opiates. It's not their white privilege, but the American dream of economic independence and advancement that has been stolen from them. The gap between the affluent and the barely scraping by is heightened by a cultural class resentment. The anger that many working-class whites feel about professional people who tell them how they ought to live and what they ought to believe. They can sense the contempt for working-class values of hard work, independence, and the Christian life that are implicit in the language and atmosphere of NPR and the New York Times and public television. Sometimes the scorn of the educated and professional elite is quite obvious, as when a New Yorker shouted at some Trump supporters in front of the Trump Tower in Manhattan, "Go back to your trailer." It's hard to make the perspective of these folks, rooted as it is in a complex social and historical context, come alive in a few words. Arlie Russell Hochschild's book, Strangers in Their Own Land, does a good job, and we will link to it and some other useful sources on the webpage for this show. But what needs to be learned by the left for organizing is, at a minimum, to contain the impulse to shower abuse and contempt on people who have supported Trump.
You shout out that the emperor's not wearing any clothes. He lies so much that you could hang your laundry from his nose. The fox is in the hen house and the wolf is at the door. But we've been through some crappy times before. We've been through some crappy times before. Indiscretions, floods, depressions, Vietnam and more. The sun has set, but don't forget, another day's in store. Cause we've been through some crappy times before.
Yes, another day is in store. That's music from the Austin Lounge Lizards here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. Now for some reflections on what might be and should be in store, we turn to Bill Resnick's conversation with Joseph Schwartz.
Hi, Joseph Schwartz. Welcome to KBOO.
Glad to be here.
Joseph Schwartz teaches politics at Temple University, writes books and articles on contemporary politics. He's also an activist, vice chair of the Democratic Socialists of America, worked in the Jesse Jackson campaign long ago, recently in for Bernie Sanders. He's also very active in Philadelphia politics, involved in budget issues, and particularly into saving public education in the city of Philadelphia. So, Joseph, the unthinkable happened. Trump won last week, the Monday before the election. This Old Mole show explored how the left could push Hillary from their corporatist and militarist inclinations towards radical politics. This week, we examine the left and Trump. Seems to me in two ways, at least we can sort of think about it in two ways. One is to figure out how to defend gains in many areas and stop this Trump onslaught. And second, not just to be stuck permanently on the defensive, to present alternatives to, in cities and states and nationally, fight for the things we believe in and the kind of country we could become. So, Joseph, I know you've been thinking about that. Give us your ideas.
Well, I think first we do have to defend the very physical security and the rights of immigrants, Muslims, Latinos, African-American activists, I mean, the people who really be on the front lines of attacks. So I think the initial demonstrations, you know, if they move into sort of, say, demands for sanctuary cities, beginning to set up sanctuary religious institutions, I think that's very important. But I think in the medium run, we really have to press the Democrats to have some spine. I think it's important. The right has filibustered inordinately on judicial appointments. I think that we've got to resist the appointments of far-right folks. I think one place where we have some openings is Trump wants to create jobs. Will he press for major infrastructure investment? If that's true, and of course the Republicans are reluctant to do that, if that's true, I think Democrats have to say that we will only support infrastructure investment if you drop your inane tax cut plans, which are going to be even worse than the Reagan and Bush tax cuts in terms of upward redistribution. I mean, it's a huge giveaway to corporate America and to the wealthy that Trump plans, and the Republicans are really into that. So I think, you know, that's one area where we may be able to resist. I think people may not want to be fooled three times by trickle down. In other words, I think Trump's real vulnerability is he probably cannot deliver massive jobs to the deindustrialized areas of the country that on the margin supported him and gave him his victory. In other words, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan. And without massive public investment, and, you know, one thing I think also the left can press that would sort of put him on the defensive is that the best way of creating jobs would be public investment in an alternative energy grid, in building a real mass transit system in this country and mass transit vehicles. And if he really wants to bring jobs, he's got to do more than just infrastructure. But I think the Democrats have to say you can't finance this intelligently if you also have massive tax cuts to the rich. So I think his vulnerability on bringing jobs to people is really evident. And I think that the Democrats and the left has to say that only by dealing with the environmental crisis can you really increase jobs, good jobs at good wages for people in areas where those jobs don't exist currently. And the private sector is not going to massively invest in those areas.
It does seem to me that it's quite possible to gain some of those things, although Trump and the Republicans will not want to raise taxes at all.
Right.
And they're basically, the Reagan period was one of huge deficits, right? They did military Keynesianism, which will happen this time, too, for sure. They're going to lavish money.
I agree. I mean, I think military hardware building is pretty capital intensive and only located in some areas of the country, usually in the Southwest, et cetera, and the South. But yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think that there's a tension between Trump's faux populism, wanting to bring real jobs, real good industrial jobs at high wages, supposedly, and real benefits, and the Republicans being prioritizing, as always, tax cuts for the rich and corporations, and also there being, and I think Trump will play along with this or has his own stinks, they're very anti-union, right? So you can't both, can't bring good jobs and good wages if you're against real massive public investment in real productive stuff, such as mass transit, alternative energy. And if you're smashing unions, that drives wages and benefits down across the country. But I think the real tension possibly between Trump and the Republicans, I mean, the question is Mike Pence and Paul Ryan going to run the government, and then Trump will just come out and celebrate their victories with speeches, which may be all he will do. But they're not really interested in, you know, good jobs or good wages. They're prioritizing tax cuts, as always. And I think the extent to which, yeah, if there's any growth in the economy, it will be because of a massive deficit-driven kind of military Keynesianism. But the problem with that is it usually leads to speculative bubbles. I mean, in other words, they're going to deregulate finance, and finance is going to make money off of money because they really won't be producing really an increase in real productivity in the economy.
Yeah, that trajectory could blow up, but it takes time, although you never know.
That's right.
You never know when the bubble is going to burst.
And also, he is under pressure to deliver on his promises. I mean, he was so megalomaniacal and sort of authoritarian. I will bring jobs. I will bring jobs. Well, the jobs don't come. But I think the immediate threat is that through executive orders, he can really do damage to the rights of the undocumented. There could be an increase from Obama's levels of deportations. And I also think in terms of environmental regulation, he has tremendous power to sort of drop a lot of the regulatory gains under Obama around fuel efficiency, around restrictions on coal-fired plants. You know, I don't think he can bring back coal jobs, but the way to try would be to get rid of all restrictions on coal-fired power plant pollution. And then, of course, the real immediate danger is what he will do to undocumented immigrants. I mean, I think we will see probably DACA overturned, so that children who came here, people who came here as children undocumented, will now be under threat that they weren't under the last few years. I think one priority has to be really in cities where we have a more progressive majority and progressive states to pass sanctuary laws. But if the federal government overturns them, so be it, and then build a sanctuary movement, you know, even more powerful than the one we built during the Central America period, where we had to defend the rights of people fleeing the civil wars in El Salvador and Nicaragua.
Right. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick here talking to Joseph Schwartz. He teaches at Temple. He's an activist. He writes, vice chair of the Democratic Socialists of America. Joseph, you talked about what the Democrats in Congress should be doing. I have the sense that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Jeff Merkley of Oregon and some of those people will, in fact, be working in concert to develop a left. I'm not sure if we can look to the Democratic Party. But where we can, it seems to me, really have impact, and you suggested it, there's a lot of cities in this country who are radically anti-Trump and have a very different view of how a government should be run and how people have to live in cities and what their needs are. And some states as well, particularly in the Northwest, of which Oregon is not a leader. California and Washington have gone much further in many things. In any event, it seems to me that cities could band together. Let's say Trump's tax cuts do go through on the rich. What if the states of the Pacific Northwest and other states enacted tax increases on the rich equal to the gains they were making under Trump? It seems to me that might be possible. I'm sure there would be great struggles, and the Republicans in Washington, D.C. would want to destroy that possibility through federalizing almost everything. It does seem to me that the cities and states have to actually take a lead, and movements in them have to take the lead in presenting the alternative. The congressional struggles are important, but they're not going to go very Right. There's limitations.
I think in some ways we're in a situation like the 1920s where the right controlled the federal government, but a lot of progressive states, particularly Wisconsin and Minnesota, began the programs of sort of worker protection and Social Security that eventually the New Deal would enact. So I do agree with you. I mean, certainly California is, you know, a model, and to some extent Washington, and you're right. I mean, the progressive movement is not as strong in Oregon, not as strong a labor base, et cetera. But those states, certainly in Illinois, New York, New Jersey, New England, I mean, do have a fair amount of power around educational policy. I think there should be a big push to build single-payer systems as much as possible, and there's going to be a huge fight over, you know, at the federal level, they're going to try to voucherize or privatize Medicaid and or block grants to the state. So, yes, I agree with you that there's a lot around housing, around economic development, around environmental protection that cities and states can do. But I think we do have to walk on two legs because the federal government, as you said, can constrain some of this, and also the federal government does raise the most revenue. But, yes, I mean, 30 years of neoliberalism means a lot of even relatively progressive states, such as California, have much more regressive tax systems, and they've begun to make them a little more progressive recently in California. But there's a lot of room to move now in terms of raising more state revenue. Progressive major cities, even Phoenix is pretty progressive. Certainly Tucson is. The problem is that they then get somewhat constrained by the state. But I agree with you that sort of building a sort of municipal socialism or municipal progressive politics and state progressive politics is really important. You know, obviously, I do fear for the people who live in the 25 states that are controlled top to bottom by the Republicans. And that's also the problem we face in Washington, is that there really is no checks and balances on what Trump and the Republicans might do, unless, and you're right, at the national level, there's been tremendous pressure on Democrats to grow some spine and not immediately, and even Richard Trumka of the AFL did this, say, we want to work with you, whatever. I mean, obviously, you have to say that rhetorically, but there has to be tremendous resistance. I mean, there has to be filibustering on reactionary Supreme Court appointments. I was suggesting earlier that if Trump wants infrastructure, I think the Democrats should say, we will filibuster infrastructure bill unless you drop your reactionary tax cuts. In other words, we need revenue to support infrastructure and job development. So you can't give away the store, the federal budget, to rich people through tax cuts and corporations through tax cuts. We have to start saying that the rich and corporations have to pay their fair share at all levels of government.
Joseph Schwartz, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Okay, no, my pleasure.
Put it there, boy, and we'll show these fascists what a couple of hillbillies can do. You may be surprised, people in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists bound to lose.
And that's Woody Guthrie with Sonny Terry on harmonica with All You Fascists Bound to Lose. Here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Clayton Morgridge, and now our movie moles Denise Morris and Jan Hocken are here to discuss and look back at a 2004 film, The Manchurian Candidate, and to think about the role corporations can play in ramping up paranoia during elections. Denise?
Thank you, Clayton. We are indeed this morning reviewing the 2004 remake of the 1962 classic film, The Manchurian Candidate, directed by Jonathan Demme. Both films are based on Richard Condon's 1959 novel of the same name. Demme's Manchurian Candidate replaces communists with corporations and the Korean War with the Gulf War. Denzel Washington stars as Major Bennett Marco, a war veteran who begins to doubt what is commonly known about his famous U.S. Army unit. During the Gulf War, Sergeant First Class Raymond Shaw, played by Liev Schreiber, supposedly rescued all but two members of his unit, of which Marco was the commanding officer. Shaw became a war hero and was awarded the Medal of Honor, launching his political career. Shaw, now a U.S. representative from New York, has been manipulated into becoming a vice presidential candidate by his over-invested senator mother, Eleanor Prentice Shaw, played by Meryl Streep. Manchurian Global, a corporation modeled after defense industry corporation Halliburton, is behind the scheme to deliver, quote, the first privately owned and operated vice president of the United States. Now, in the context of perpetual war on terrorism and using the politics of fear to gain politically, the Shaw campaign rallies itself around the slogan compassionate vigilance and tells voters, quote, "I know how much Americans have to fear today. I believe that freedom from fear is not negotiable. We must secure tomorrow today." And it has a 1984 kind of tinge to it as well. So, Jan, you actually have a lot of expertise to lend to this review, given that you've done a lot of work around PTSD, a lot of work around veterans' mental health, and also memory, which plays a large role in this film. Yourself and other reviewers have noted that this film is sort of like the Gulf War syndrome goes to the movies.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to, you can do a number of things with this film in the present context. We could spend a whole hour on lessons to be learned from the Manchurian Candidate. I mean, both films, I think it's useful to remember that both films came to the cinemas during a period of palpable acute political crisis where many people felt the world was coming to an end as they knew it. The first Manchurian Candidate film came to the cinemas in October 24th, 1962, in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the Cold War came really close to a nuclear war with Cuba that was part of the JFK administration. And the first film also really registered a lot of the Cold War anxiety about the Korean veterans and brainwashing. There was actually a very extensive CIA program in the 50s studying mind control and the role of LSD and other hallucinogenic drugs in inducing altered states, and whether you could implant a command in a person through hypnosis that they would execute later, even if it went in opposition to their moral beliefs. And so there was a lot of this, the dark methods of psychology that were mythologized in the film and in the broader culture, thinking you could hypnotize people and hypnotize soldiers and to get them to do horrific things. In actuality, though, soldiers do horrific things under the command of the military, but not in the way that the Manchurian Candidate envisioned it or people involved in these mind control experiments envisioned it. So I think that's kind of an interesting way in which a film takes some amount of reality and then enlarges it into a kind of paranoid worldview. Similarly with the Gulf War syndrome, in this, there was this sense of soldiers in the Persian Gulf War being injected or implanted with experimental forms of mind control, and then they become plants for carrying out assassins when they return home. Actually, there is a lot of anxiety about veterans coming home as walking time bombs, as people who've been morally contaminated by war. But these films kind of take it in a very concrete direction, and particularly with this idea of mind control that's there in both films.
And certainly there wouldn't be any lack of evidence to show, in terms of the 2004 film, that a corporation could take the role of this other menace, that red menace that was created and was pretty hypnotizing for the American public. But still, somehow the film had to create some level of paranoia to fulfill the dream of what of the message of Manchurian Candidate. And we've talked a lot about paranoia, its role in the political imagination, and its detriment to paranoia and conspiracy in real politics. And paranoia being just a brief, because you can speak to this a little bit more, just this meant understood as a mental condition characterized by delusions of persecution and typically elaborated into an organized system. So the political landscape is a perfect place for paranoia to take form with all of our secret government agencies and, you know, the role of corporations, the role of veterans in politics over time.
Yeah, and I think paranoia plays well at the movies because a lot of people do feel persecuted by hidden forces that are kind of veiled and operating in secret. And actually, Jonathan Demme, the director of the 2004 version of Manchurian Candidate, also spoke to the sense of apocalyptic crisis of the period. It was right after, of course, 9/11, the bombings that followed, the rollback in civil liberties, and he was asked about the paranoia of the film, and he said, well, we have a lot to be paranoid about.
During that election cycle, Bush was running again for a second term.
There's a lot of also ways in which the role of the military in presidential elections, which I'm sure we will return to many times in the upcoming period, that in presidential elections, actually in the political class in general, veterans are fewer and lower percent of the political class. So dropping number of veterans who actually serve as part of the political class. But veterans still play an important symbolic role. And I think that was kind of an interesting aspect of the remake, because there was always this question of George Bush Jr., how he had gotten out of military service. Veterans are routinely trotted out for their symbolic role in the defense of the country. And there's
and
always
an authentic relationship to defending, you know, America and defending its freedom and
right.
Protecting people from the horrors of terror, you know, yeah, all of it.
And his malevolent, evil mother in the 2004 version, who is scheming to get her son into power as president. She fights for his candidacy, saying, who better can win an election than a battle-tested combat veteran who faces the dark night, evil in the dark night of the desert, you know? And as it turns out, the film also exposes this as a myth, because her son is an instrument of these malevolent forces and has no mind of his own, and all of them have been kind of morally corrupted by the war. So it kind of plays with this idea. And in somewhat of a parody, too, there's an element of camp or parody in satirical side to the 2004 version and the way politics play with veterans and the symbols of war.
I thought it was entertaining. I don't think that now, reflecting 12 years back, the idea of corporations as these evil, manipulative entities to be paranoid about is, you know, it's pretty, it seems kind of a common experience, but the film is, I mean, it is an entertaining film, and I think what it has to offer is happening on a completely different level than just that element of the corporation and its role in politics. And so, moving on to the character of Marco, his role in this is to be kind of the vessel that brings us through his processes of remembering what happened. And
he's the veteran who led a platoon that was mysteriously wiped out, and they've actually been the subject of a mind control experiment. But his nightmares are the kind of the revelatory truth of what actually happened. And this was, and so he's tortured by nightmares, by symptoms, and that this was also, I think it registered the Gulf War syndrome politics, and that by and large, that generation of veterans rejected the diagnosis of PTSD. They felt something had been really done to them on a medical, physical level, and the PTSD really was a whitewash. It was a way of saying you're crazy, when they felt they had been neurologically damaged by experimental drugs and that kind of thing, and that their nightmares were actually carrying some truth of that. They weren't delusional. And so there was very much that sensibility. And I think people often forget or are not aware of the struggles historically over how to think about the suffering of veterans and what they're bringing home and how much they carry the truth of the contradictions and the lies of the military, and not simply that they've been shell-shocked by their service.
Right. And Marco says at one point regarding the incident of the unit and the attack and the saving and all of that that happened that led to Shaw becoming decorated as a war hero. He says, I remember that it happened, but I don't remember it happening. And that carries that sensibility that you're getting at right there, I think.
Yeah, and I think it also registers some of the romantic sensibilities around memory and trauma of the 1990s, that even though he's had these memories implanted in him, there's some part of his being that holds the essential truth of it, a kind of uncontaminated, pure truth of what happened. So it's, I think, an interesting film to give us a little distance from the present and to realize that there's been this sense of the world coming to an end as we know it through the power of evildoers for a very long time.
Yeah, it's not, unfortunately, nothing new. And as we've been saying this morning on The Old Mole, we've been through tough times before. We'll be tracking those tough times.
And you can overstate the power of the global ruling class.
Exactly.
And there's some element of that in this film, the Manchurian Candidate as well.
Yeah. Well, this is Denise Morth with Jan Hocken. We've been reviewing the 2004 remake of The Manchurian Candidate for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife and children, but I've many friends, and some of them are with me. An old woman gave us shelter, kept us hidden in the garret. Then the soldiers came. She died without a whisper. There were three of us this morning. I'm the only one this evening, but I must go on. The frontiers are my prison. The wind is blowing. Through the graves the wind is blowing. Freedom soon will come. Then we'll come from the shadows.
And that, of course, is the late and great Leonard Cohen singing The Partisan. It has been written that war is politics continued by other means. And sometimes, often in fact, it comes to that. This is not to say that anything like the situation Leonard sings about in that song obtains here and now, but it does remind us of the level of commitment that political action in the face of tyranny can require. This leads to a related question about the situation that does obtain here and now, and that is, what kind or degree of change do we on the socialist left propose? When we criticize the system or the establishment, what exactly do we mean? Here to set up this question is Jack Johnson.
So where does that leave us? Here, I want to suggest we make a distinction. I got it from a friend of mine, and it's helped clarify my thinking quite a lot. I'm passing it along to you now. The distinction is between matters of policy, politics, on the one hand, and on the other, matters of law, rule of law, governance structure, the republic. I think, to start, that the policy challenges ahead are enormous. It's very likely that Trump, having no policy commitments of his own, will reach for those nearest him, which we know very well. It's very likely that the New Deal will be rolled back, perhaps to its beginning. It's very likely that the Great Society will be rolled back to its beginning. It's also very likely that national assets will be sold off to oligarchs and would-be oligarchs. All of these are policy decisions, disastrous in their own right, and they need to be opposed. So I think. But now look at the second category. These are issues of rule of law, governance structure, norms of our politics and civil society. Those are under attack now in a way they've not been for generations. The dangers there are deep. I'd like to urge all my friends on the left and the right to dedicate themselves in the first instance to preserving the structure we have. We know what the models are. There are several of them very nearby. Poland, Hungary, Turkey, Russia. We know what can happen. We're being warned now by serious people that we're in danger of much the same thing as they've suffered. The people warning of this come from every side, from the left to the right, Republican, Democrat, Independent. This is to some degree reassuring. The threat is recognized, but merely recognizing the threat doesn't disarm it. So I'd like to suggest, in particular, to my friends on the left, after many years, generations, of regarding the establishment with deep distrust, after years of calling for its shaking up, I'd like to ask that you think seriously about what it will take in the years ahead to preserve it. This is Jack Johnson for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And that was our special contributor, Jack Johnson, pointing out that the fabric of rules within which political discourse is supposed to take place in the United States is in danger of being undermined by the forces that have been empowered by last week's election, and that it should be a priority of the left to defend those basic principles. I take it that these are the principles enshrined in the Bill of Rights. They make up the framework of democracy. Jack seems to be suggesting that the left, in its desire to fundamentally alter the social order, should remember to fight for those parts of that social order that keep political activity peaceful, the norms that make the practice of democracy possible and prevent our politics from turning into war. Just two comments about this. First, it seems to me it is an essential role of the left to protect and defend political liberty and open discussion and access to information and ideas, and that most of the left, at least in the United States, has done so. It has nearly always been and continues to be governments and right-wing movements that have threatened these principles and that have turned politics into war by other means. Now, my second comment. Jack distinguished between matters of policy on the one hand and, on the other hand, matters of government structure and the rule of laws, the principles I suggested are written in the Bill of Rights. There is another distinction to be made, and that is between democracy and capitalism. Socialists believe that democracy and capitalism are incompatible, for capital is the right and the power of capital, supported by the state, to make use of human labor, of human lives, in whatever ways will profit the wealthy owners of capital. The phenomenon of Trump is a development within capitalism, powered fundamentally by working-class anger at the tyranny and oppression of capital. We can and must fight now, as Bill Resnick and Joseph Schwartz argued earlier on in the program, for the best deal we can get within the capitalist order of things. But in the long run, the struggle for the freedom and equality that is so threatened today is for an end to the private ownership of capitalists of the conditions of our lives. That is the element of the system we hope to shake up. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Now, Bill Resnick returns to talk with author Chuck Collins about bringing some of the wealthy into the fight for a more egalitarian society. Bill.
Thank you, Clayton. Chuck Collins, welcome to KABU.
Hey, Bill. Great to be with you.
Chuck Collins is going to be in Portland tomorrow. He's talking at the First Unitarian Church, which is on 12th and Salmon, on his new book, Born on Third Base. Here's what Barbara Ehrenreich said about Chuck Collins and that new book. I have never read a story remotely like the one Chuck Collins has to tell. Born to the 1%, he grew an outsized conscience and gave up his inherited wealth for a life of fighting the vicious inequality that is destroying our country. Somewhere along the way, he came to understand that the rich can be part of the solution instead of the problem, and started organizing them to join in the struggle for a fair economy. Chuck Collins, you'll be speaking tomorrow again at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian. In this interview, in our limited time, I'm hoping we could discuss what part of the solution do you see the rich playing, and what roles do you see them in?
Well, I think one important thing is to realize that the wealthy aren't monolithic. So there is this segment of the rich that rig the rules to get more wealth and power. But there are others like the Patriotic Millionaires Network and others who I think can validate the struggles. For instance, you know, there are business leaders who are very, very eloquent about why we should be raising minimum wages and living wages. There are wealthy people who have historically stood up against tax cuts. And again, we're mobilizing now as President-elect Trump that says he wants to get rid of the inheritance tax, the estate tax again. Part of that movement will be the people who pay that taxes who are standing up and saying, this is why we should pay it. And I also think that wealthy people can disrupt the narrative of deservedness, this idea that, oh, these inequalities exist because we live in a meritocracy and people get what they deserve. And what I found is that a lot of wealthy people tell their story, the people I'm helping organize, tell their story in a way that sort of shows how society and other workers and others have contributed to their wealth. So they question that powerful myth of individual achievement. So I think those are some of the ways that the wealthy can play a role.
Yeah, and because of their wealth and often fame, if only in local areas where they may be the big employers or make major contributions, they have a very big megaphone. And if they're really challenging a lot of the basic myths that maintain the old social order and the capacity for the wealthy to become so enriched and further enriched, that is, it seems to me, an important role. Let me talk about another role that they may be playing and that you deal with in the book, or why don't you talk about the enormously important, the profound importance of dealing with climate. Profound is understates it, of dealing with global warming and climate change, which is leading to mass extinctions, including maybe this species, and in the long run as it plays out. Chuck, talk about the ecological role that you see them within that struggle.
You know, I think it's an example where, and I've made this argument, that look, there is no wealth on a degraded earth. Wealth is worthless if soil and land and water are contaminated. And I think a lot of very wealthy people understand that. They actually see, maybe because they get the jet set around, they see the impact of ecological change around the world. You know, I think about somebody like Tom Steyers, who's a gazillionaire who stepped up and put tens of millions of dollars into changing the politics around climate change. And I think my goal is to recruit another 100 Tom Steyers who support student groups and support organizing efforts and help organizations get smarter around communications and talk about how it's going to fundamentally undermine everything that we care about. So you're right, Bill. This is a group of people that, for good or bad reasons, have a bigger megaphone, and it's good when they use it to support and validate the organizing work that other people are doing.
Yeah, the question I think I have that has to be addressed is that at some point it seems to me where if we are going to be able to deal with the climate crisis and save at least some percentage of the species and manage to have a sustainable economy and livable Earth, at least the climate scientists, it's not just a left that says it, sees the need for absolute fundamental change in our system, including a very different vision of growth. That is, we just can't keep going on with exponential growth and using more, extracting more resources and the rest of it, and therefore in some ways depleting the planet, if it's the soils or the oceans or the atmosphere or global warming. It can't go on forever. And since the capitalist system is really at the logic of the heart of it is exponential growth, that people don't invest unless they can make a good return on it. And the return has to at least be above average, so they're constantly fighting and competing. It seems to me that system has to end. I'm sure there are wealthy people who sort of recognize that, as you did long ago, and are ready, in fact, to accept the kind of democratic planning and democratic and very bold letters in every way, it seems to me. But who can accept that? I think most of them, and also their servants, the sort of the high priest economists who preach more growth than the rest and how good it is for mankind, that all of their servants, lobbyists, politicians, higher managers, they're going to find it very difficult to accept that verdict. I guess parts of the wealthy you think can sort of checkmate those who are just completely unwilling and make the kinds of changes that are necessary.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Bill. I mean, the band is not going to keep playing. The perpetual growth machine, the kind of extractive capitalism that we're living with that's destroying nature. And what I'm seeing is very powerful examples. I see the divest, invest movement where people who own capital are actually withdrawing it entirely from the fossil fuel industry and actually shifting it not to just other market, other stocks or whatever, but actually into local just transition type ventures, worker-owned energy companies. And that means a lower rate of return. But for some wealthy people, they understand that that's the change, that there aren't going to be these mega returns. And in fact, the role of capital in building the new society is going to be subordinate to community enterprises and other democratic needs. And so I think people are modeling that through this divest and reinvest in the new just transition, the new energy economy. That's just one example. And there's this network confluence philanthropy. There's like $3 trillion of money that's being sort of taken out of Wall Street and put into very different kinds of ventures that are more community controlled and worker owned and are really the livelihoods of the future. So I think we are in a transition to a new system that's going to be entirely rewired within the constraints of nature. And I think there's a people with capital can help move that faster. That's my hope. And my case to the wealthy is, look, we got to change the trajectory yesterday. So it's time to step up with all due haste. And other people are just trying to survive. And if people have the resources where they can make a difference, that they have an obligation to help society make that transition as fast as possible.
Yeah, to convert some of that wealth or as much as possible to building the infrastructure and the models that would lead to the new economy. I think that's part of what you're suggesting. But tomorrow night, you're going to be speaking at the First Unitarian Church at 7 o'clock. I understand you'll be there before and after to talk, and you're going to be addressing all of these questions. I hope all the Phil Knight comes and the others, and they also devote their fortunes to something besides football, his major charitable endeavor.
Anyway, I hope so, too.
Chuck, keep up the good work. Thank you. Thanks for talking.
Thanks, Bill.
And see you tomorrow night.
Come on out and check out inequality.org, too, which is the portal for all the work that we do.
Oh, right, that with IPS, inequality.org. Thanks a lot for talking.
Thanks, Bill.
And thank you, Bill. Well, that concludes this special edition election wrap-up of the Old Mole Variety Hour. Many thanks to Bill Resnick and Joseph Schwartz for their discussion of the way forward in the coming Trump years, to our movie moles Denise Morris and Jan Hawken for their discussion of the Manchurian candidate and what it suggests about our politics, and to Chuck Collins for his conversation with Bill about the possibilities of outreach to the rich. I want to thank also George Greenwald for putting me onto the Austin Lounge Lizard song, Crappy Times Are Here Again. Special thanks also to Jack Johnson for his thoughtful work, which helped me to clarify my ideas about where we are today and how we got here and where we must go. And thanks to our engineer, Patsy Kullberg, for keeping things running smoothly. Now a couple of announcements about Standing Rock. First of all, Portland artists, painters, potters, sculptors, weavers, glass and textile artists, and everything in between, you're invited to make donations of artwork for a December 4th dinner and auction fundraiser for winter supplies at Standing Rock, sponsored by Southwest Washington, No Dakota Access Pipeline, and Black Lives Matter in Vancouver. For more information, call Robin White at 360-608-8537. Also, tomorrow at 4 p.m., there will be a demonstration supporting the Standing Rock protesters. That's at 4 p.m. at the United States Corps of Engineers at 333 Southwest 1st. Well, tune in again next week to hear more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Underground Perspective. You can find this show and others of our ilk on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up in a day or two, and also look for us on Facebook and Twitter.